Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 17. As expected, the fire in the wood stove had long since gone out, and a deep chill permeated the main house when Callie arrived. She shed her coat and boots and immediately sought out the warmth of the cat room, turning on all the lights as she went in an effort to dispel the gloom. "Come to Mummy, kitties," she burbled foolishly as she opened the door, aching to feel them swarm around her feet, to drop down amid their warm, purring bodies, and shed the tears she'd held in for so many hours. Instead of a welcoming swarm of hungry cats, a serene tableau greeted her. All of them curled up on their little pillows or stretched out on their benches sound asleep, a picture of contentment, all perfectly still. Too still. Callie rushed into the room and grabbed Bernice, then Venus, Howard, George, Gwendolyn, Zed, David, and Marilyn. No breath. No heartbeat. All dead. Long dead. No, 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 they can't be. Not like this. She instinctively flung open the windows, then checked the other cats. Alicia, Justine, Maytag, Sparky, Sanford, Freya, Florence, and Rex. Dead. All of them dead. She tried to think, but her mind had been filled to overflowing before she entered the room. Now thoughts piled up on each other so swiftly she couldn't make sense of any of them. Her medical background screamed, "Carbon monoxide poisoning! It was the heater!" But she didn't want to hear that. Billy had checked the heater. Billy could do anything with his hands. Everyone knew that. Billy would never hurt the cats. Billy would never hurt her. Piercing the chaotic thoughts assaulting her, she heard a voice repeating the same words over and over again. "Dear God, please don't let me lose my mind." With growing horror, she recognized the voice as her own. Worse, she realized she was compulsively picking up all the empty cat food dishes so she could wash and fill them with a special treat because she'd been gone so long. The stainless steel bowls fell out of her hands and hit the floor with a clatter. She fled into the kitchen and leaned against the wall, trembling uncontrollably, knowing, as she had never known it before, that she could not lose it. She had to deal with this. Now. Another litany replaced the first. "Bury the cats, Callie. Bury the cats. Under the tree with Nana." She pulled on her work boots and yanked her old barn jacket from the peg by the kitchen door. Her hands shook so violently she couldn't button the coat, but the cold night air cleaned her head enough that she managed to locate a shovel in the shed and start digging. The rocky ground had already started to freeze, and it took forever to dig just one tiny grave. Eventually, though, she dug an arc of 5 graves around Nana and buried Bernice, Venus, Howard, George, and Zed in them. Then she dug a second arc parallel to the first and buried more little bodies, and then a third. By the time she finished, 30 little mounds of dirt surrounded Nana. Knowing the cat she didn't even know had died too made it even more unbearable than it already was. Snack cats, Billy had called them, the random ones Gwendolyn, Sanford, and Rex invited inside for a treat. She dropped to her knees in front of them and wept. "Don't cry," ordered the voice in her head. "There's no time for that now." She knew that, but the house in her life seemed so profoundly empty and so horribly wrong without all those cats. She prowled through the rooms, unable to fix herself something to eat or drink, or even get into bed. All those activities and countless others had become inextricably entwined with the cats. How could she possibly fix herself something to eat until she had fed the cats? How could she possibly go to bed without them? Especially today. The recognition that the cats had become the glue that held her present life together, as well as symbols of a past she had yet to reconcile, made her feel on the verge of spinning out of control. Had Billy's memorial service not loomed on the horizon to anchor her, she would have done exactly that. But Billy's service did loom on the horizon, and that became Callie's focus. Once she convinced herself that she could take a shower without cleaning the litter boxes first, she spent a long interval scrubbing out the dirt that had ground in her hands when she removed her gloves to pack down the soil on each little grave. More time passed as she selected Billy's favorite tapes and compact discs from her collection, including clusters of seconds spent reaching out to stroke a cat who wasn't there. Then she built a fire in the stove and burned all the censored photos she brought home from Billy's. When only their ashes remained, she sat on the couch and watched the flames die down for another hour, trying to decide what to wear to Billy's memorial service, her black wool dress or something else. "The black dress isn't a viable option," came another knee-jerk response. "It shows cat hair too well." But now it was an option, because there weren't any cats. But she decided to wear her navy suit anyhow, because Billy didn't like black, she told the empty room. Once Callie made that decision, she got the garment from the bedroom closet without ever once looking at the bed. And all the while, the little voice kept telling her, "Don't break down. You can deal with this." By the time she reached the granary, Callie had convinced herself she looked composed rather than numb. In fact, she wasn't so numb that she couldn't appreciate the expert job Pan and Joe had done decorating the walls with Billy Blue streamers to which they'd attached Billy's pictures. While Pan and his wife manned the tables laden with food and beverages, Joe accepted tapes, compact discs, and even records from those who had come to pay their final respects. And he played these while a constant stream of Addison residents looked at the pictures and sampled the food made by Billy's friends and neighbors. Shortly after Callie arrived, a woman she recognized as the one in a hot clinch with a priest in one of Billy's censored photos introduced herself as Addison's new librarian, Deborah Kane. "I'm also the unofficial curator of the Historical Society," she informed Callie, nervously coiling and uncoiling the damp handkerchief she held in her hands. "Billy's pictures reveal so much about town life the past 40 years, I'd like to have them for our permanent collection, if possible. People should be able to see them, all of them. It's too valuable a record to let any one individual's feelings get in the way." She took a deep breath, looked Callie straight in the eye, and added, "Including mine." "Sorry, I can't oblige you." Callie found the woman's integrity refreshing after dealing with the likes of Chucky Getz. "It's all right." Deborah Kane bowed her head slightly. "Billy was a very special person, and I can understand why you want to keep them." "You misunderstand," Callie corrected her. "You can have the pictures, but you can't have all of them. There were some that Billy and I thought it would be better for me to burn." Relief flooded the librarian's delicate features, and she shook Callie's hand firmly. "Thank you very much. Billy said you were special, and now I see why." That comment caused a huge lump to form in Callie's throat, but she choked it back enough to tell the librarian that she'd drop the remaining pictures off in a few days. No sooner did Deborah Kane move away than Chucky Getz slithered over and put a clammy hand on Callie's shoulders. "Say, Callie, about that picture of me," he began, his eyes shifting nervously toward his beady-eyed wife, who looked more whale than fish-like in her gray dress as she stood beside Penn consuming large quantities of food. "What about it?" Callie asked, shrugging off his hand.
"I was wondering if I could, buy it,"
he whispered, glancing around furtively.
"Come on, Callie, it's no use to you."
"Chucky, how can you say that? You look so cute and adorable, leering at that bimbo half your age. I'd be a fool not to want such a priceless photo for my collection."
"Cut it out,"
he hissed as his wife began lumbering in their direction.
"You're not that kind of a person."
"How do you know? I spent the last 8 years in California, and I learned some pretty strange things out there," she countered, raising her voice just enough to cause him to squirm. "Besides, I already donated the whole collection to the Historical Society, so I can't give it to you anyway."
"You did what?"
His voice left the hiss realm and moved toward a shout.
"That's right. So if you want something from it, I suggest you get in touch with the town librarian."
The color drained out of his face. "On the other hand," she added, because she felt sorry for him but for the life of her didn't know why, "she might tell you that I burned all the pictures Billy or I thought might make someone unhappy."
A decent person would have thanked her for sharing this, but not Chucky Getz. He simply stormed off, reminding her why she and Billy had used the same sign for Chucky and Poopy from their first days in nursery school. She turned around and ran smack into Bernie Romano. "My goodness, for someone with dengue fever, you certainly pack a wallop," she complained, rubbing her arm. "Dengue fever? Who told you I had that?" he asked, dumbfounded. "Justine. She said you were dying." "She says silly things like that sometimes," he replied, then looked very sad. "The brain tumor makes her do it." "Get to the point, Bernie. I'm beginning to feel a little sick myself," she prodded him. He looked at the ceiling and then tugged the cuff of his shiny lawyer sports coat. "Someone said you had all of Billy's pictures." "And?" "And that they were in chronological order." "So?" "So at the Fireman's Parade 2 years ago, I had a little too much to drink and met this real looker. God, she was so beautiful in this little blue halter. I just couldn't resist. I know Billy took pictures of us, and I was wondering if..." "If you could have the pictures?" He nodded. "With Justine so sick and all, knowing I looked at another woman could... Well, I just don't want to think about what it could do to her." "Sure you can have them," Callie smiled sweetly. "I think I saw them pinned up over there by the main entrance."
"No,"
he gasped, and got even whiter than Chucky. "How could you do that to me after we've been friends for so long?" "Easy, Bernie," Kelly soothed him as she patted him on his greasy little head. "You were so drunk you were putting the moves on your own wife." He mumbled something derogatory and moved away, leaving her to ponder the possibility that the fact that she could lose her mind at any minute had nothing to do with having wildly eccentric parents, a perverted uncle, and 30 dead cats in her backyard. It could be because she spent her formative years with the likes of Chucky, Bernie, and Justine. Aside from those interludes, and were she a native of California rather than New Hampshire, Callie would have called what occurred that afternoon a memorial happening rather than a service. Joe had turned up the bass on his system, and standing near a speaker, she could feel as well as hear the music. With a little effort, she mentally blocked out the sound so she only felt it, and experienced it for the first time as Billy had his entire life. During the ensuing hours, everyone came to pay tribute to Billy, from the town's oldest citizen in her wheelchair to Andy and his wife with their new baby. And many of them brought their pets, including the junior herpetologist with his boa. "Billy liked her and she liked him too," he proclaimed defiantly, looking as if he would burst into tears when he noticed Penn eyeing him suspiciously. "I know, son." Penn patted both the boy and the snake on the head. "It's all right." Joe, Penn, and Kelly had toyed with the idea of asking someone to make a formal speech, and the minister from the Congregational Church had volunteered to do the job. In the end, she vetoed the plan because it seemed an inappropriate way to bid farewell to someone who never spoke or heard a word in his life. At first, Kelly worried that those who came would find this lack of any formal service far more improper. But as she watched, an incredible scene unfolded before her. Penn and Joe had spread the pictures out on the streamers in an effort to decorate as much of the large building as possible. As a result, each picture claimed its own private space and, naturally, curiosity led each visitor to seek out his or her own favorite picture with Billy. Then they would stand in front of it for a while doing something she couldn't see, then eventually turn away with tears in their eyes. A little girl about 4 solved the mystery for Callie late in the afternoon when she found her picture with Billy on a low-hanging streamer filled with other youngsters' pictures near where Callie stood. The child studied the picture for a while, then waved one little hand, pointed to herself, curved her pudgy thumbs and index fingers into semicircles that she joined to form a tiny heart, and pointed to Billy in the picture. "Goodbye, Billy. I love you." She turned and looked at Callie. "Did you say goodbye to Billy, too?" she asked. "Not yet," Callie told her, "but I'm going to now." In a corner near the lean-to, semi-sheltered by a display of pet food where Pen or Joe had tucked it, Callie found a picture of herself and Billy lying face down in the dirt, watching the ants swarm over Billy's peanut butter sandwich. She didn't use the same hand signals used by the little girl or anyone else who signed a final farewell to Billy Paradise that afternoon, but she knew he understood. "Goodbye, Billy. I love you, too." And then she ran out of the building. Joe McDermott watched Callie's exchange with the little girl and her final farewell to Billy Paradise, his chest so tight he felt like he was drowning.
You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.